In the first hour today, we'll be talking with historian Neil Ferguson. He says that finance has always been the foundation of human progress. That's a kind of argument that he lays out and elaborates in his recent book, The Ascent of Money. The subtitle is A Financial History of the World. It's published by the Penguin Press. He makes this argument that this journey has not always been smooth. Certainly, we have experienced a roller coaster ride of bubbles and busts, kind of like the one that we're in now. Still, he says, financial history is the essential backstory behind all history. The book takes a look at the development of a number of things like money and credit, and it also explores the idea that the financial system both reflects and magnifies the qualities that make us human. Our guest, Neil Ferguson, is one of Britain's most renowned historians. He's professor of history at Harvard University. He's a senior research fellow of Jesus College, Oxford, senior fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and has authored a number of books. You can look for them at the bookstore, including the new one. Let me also mention real quickly that on PBS, there will be a program based on The Ascent of Money that will air early next year, and we will run it on our television station, WILL-TV, and that will be at 8 o'clock on Tuesday, January 13th, so you can tune in for that, in addition to going out and to the library or to the bookstore and looking for the book. So either way, you can certainly learn more. Professor Ferguson, hello.
David, it's a pleasure to join you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I'm interested in having you expand on this idea, and I mentioned it in my introduction, and you have it here in the book. You write, if the financial system has a defect, it is that it reflects and magnifies what we human beings are like. Talk about that.
Well, I suppose we're living through a perfect illustration of this point. It doesn't seem so long ago that Alan Greenspan was warning about irrational exuberance, and that was at a fairly early stage of the 1990s stock market bubble. We had another bout of irrational exuberance when we thought that the value of our houses would just keep going up and guarantee us a comfortable retirement. And then with an extraordinary speed in 2007, and particularly in the last few months, this exuberance has given way to panic. And indeed, depression. It's no coincidence that we use a word like depression to describe a really big economic crisis, because it has to do with mood. It has to do with psychology. When Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 gave his inaugural address, he told Americans the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. John Maynard Keynes, who was in many ways the most brilliant economist to think about the problem of depression, used to talk about the role of animal spirits in financial markets. So any history of finance, like The Ascent of Money, has to concern itself not just with the nuts and bolts of bond issuance, interest rates, and all the rest of it, but fundamentally it has to be concerned with human psychology.
Yeah, I'm very struck by, in having read some of the things about the book and some of the comments that you have made about the current economic downturn, that I think as long ago as perhaps sometime last year, you were talking with people who were very important in the financial industry and were warning about the possibility that such a thing could happen, and you were universally dismissed. They just said to you, oh, no, that couldn't possibly happen. And that's, you know, given the fact that there have been serious downturns in the past, it does seem to be striking that we somehow, particularly when we're in the midst of a bubble, we just can't seem to bring ourselves to believe the fact that it could burst.
That's absolutely right. I spent much of 2006 writing papers and giving lectures on the dangers of a liquidity crisis, trying to point out that if you had a sudden contraction of credit, highly leveraged institutions, ranging from governments to banks to households, would find themselves in deep difficulty. And it was rather difficult to sell this idea to the investment bankers, not to mention the hedge fund managers, and indeed many mainstream economists. I found myself in a very small, motley group of Dr. Dooms, along with my old friend at NYU, Nouriel Roubini, and Nicholas Nassim Taleb, author of The Black Swan. I think we were the leading prophets of disaster, and it was hard to get a hearing. One got invited to give talks about this, I think primarily in order to provide entertainment at the party. It was very hard to persuade anybody in 2006 just how near we were to the perfect financial storm. And when it struck, the looks of mystification, even on the faces of the masters of the universe, were really worth the price of admission.
Mm. Well, I wonder, do you think that, to some extent, the financial system has to be based on people's faith in this respect, that we agree that certain things have certain value, and often these things don't have intrinsic value. They only have value because we assign value to them.
This is a profound and philosophical point that I deal with in the early chapters of The Ascent of Money. Money itself is a relationship more than anything else. It's a relationship between a creditor and a debtor, between a borrower and a lender. And that relationship has to be based on trust. It's no coincidence that the word credit has as its root the Latin credo, I believe. We have to believe in the money that represents the transactions between us, the relationships between us in the financial world. And the critical point is that when faith is lost, when credibility is lost in the monetary system, that the results are quite dramatic. A bank panic is a perfectly good illustration of this. When people suddenly stop believing that the money they've deposited at a bank is still there and available, there's a run on the bank, and the bank can't possibly survive unless it's bailed out by government. I try to talk about this to explain the psychology of bank panics as an example of the extent to which all financial relationships are fundamentally based on trust. And when trust is lost, the consequences can be quite spectacular. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Neil Ferguson. He's professor of history at Harvard University. His most recent book is The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. It's published by the Penguin Press, in which he takes a look at the evolution of a number of financial institutions, including banking, the bond market, the stock market, the insurance market, the real estate market, the globalization of the economy. It's all there in the book if you want to take a look at it. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Presumably, human beings got along for some time on barter, but you seem to be making the argument that that'll only take you so far. And if a society is going to grow, at some point you need money. Does it matter, though, what it is you use for that? Maybe this is going back to an earlier point. Does it matter what it is you use as long as everybody agrees what it's worth?
That's absolutely right. Anything can be money. In ancient Babylon, 4,000 years ago, little clay tablets served the role of money. Later, it was circular pieces of metal with the heads of kings stamped on them. In our time, paper money became more important than coinage. But even more important than paper money is the money in our bank accounts. When people talk about the money supply today, they're talking about something that is largely invisible. It only notionally exists inside the banks. And when we go to an ATM and take out a little bit of plastic, we're really taking out something that has the same significance as a clay tablet in ancient Babylon. In fact, a large amount of the money in the world today is wholly invisible and has no physical form other than perhaps numbers on a computer screen. That's something that many people have trouble getting their heads around. People often ask me, where did the money go? Where is the money? And they struggle a bit when I tell them that there really isn't a great vault somewhere with all the money physically in it, great piles of banknotes or gold bars for that matter. So I think the key to understanding money is to recognize that all money is in some sense a token. In Berlin in 1945, at the end of World War II, cigarettes served the function of money. In the Soviet system, denim jeans from the West could perform the function of money. So anything can be money, and as you rightly say, David, the critical thing is there should be mutual trust and agreement that these tokens have value. Barter is very inefficient. If my publisher said, we'll pay you for this book that you've written in the form of other books, I would be very reluctant to agree. A, I already have plenty of books, and B, if I wanted to then go and buy something like a college education for my kids, it's unlikely that the university would want to be paid in books too. So barter never really had much of a future as a system of exchange. That's why money arose quite early, right at the beginning, in fact, of the history of civilization. And you can't really point to many civilizations that didn't have money. A rare example would be the Inca Empire. But the Inca Empire proved to be very, very fragile when it was confronted by the money-hungry conquistadors from Spain. Mm.
Well, we're now used to the idea that precious metals are valuable. The coinage has been made out of them for a long time, or at least going back a long way, and now we're still wearing them as adornments and paying significant amounts of paper or using our plastic or whatever to buy these things. Why is it that people so early on settled on these particular metals as being the basis for their literally they made their money out of that? But even when we got to the point where we're using paper for a long time, we still had this idea that the precious metals backed up the paper.
From ancient Greece through the Roman Empire, right the way down to the mid-20th century, it was assumed that money should be either directly made of or indirectly related to precious metal, gold or silver. And coinage from the ancient world right down to the 20th century tended to be made of those metals, as well as copper for the less valuable small denominations. Now, the reason for this is fairly obvious. Gold is a particularly enduring metal. It doesn't tarnish. It looks pretty nice. I think that goes without saying. And it's rare. There's not much of it, which means that because we like the look of it, because it doesn't tarnish and because it's rare, it tends to have a fairly constant and high value in relation to other commodities that are more plentiful and don't last so long or tarnish. So the appeal of gold is a perennial phenomenon, and indeed societies have valued gold that didn't have money. The Incas liked gold for decorative purposes. They just had no concept of using it as a means of exchange. Mm-hmm. Today, you'll encounter gold bugs, gold enthusiasts, who will tell you that the dollar is doomed because of the way in which the Federal Reserve is trying to combat the Depression, and the only sure store of value is gold. In fact, some people even talk about a potential return to the gold standard, the system that arose in the 18th and 19th century, which tied all money to gold reserves. Now, I think there's a lot to be said for having some gold in your portfolio, not least because it's a pretty good hedge against inflation. But I wouldn't see it as anything more than that. It's just a commodity that looks nice, is rare, and doesn't tarnish. We'll never go back to the gold standard, not least because the gold standard wasn't a particularly wonderful monetary system. It caused two periods of very steep deflation when prices actually fell in the 1870s and 80s, and then again in the 1930s. And the last thing that we need now is deflation. The last thing we need is to tie our monetary systems rigidly to a really quite small amount of gold.
You know, I'm interested in this idea that gold is a good hedge against inflation, that people continue to believe that. At the same time, the price of gold can be very volatile, and all you have to do is look back to earlier this year at the point where the economy was really turning sour. People were worrying the price of oil had shot way up and the price of gold shot way up. And then so we saw people running out and buying gold because they thought that that would be a good investment. And after a few months, the price dropped back now. So I think it was what was maybe around $800 an ounce, and now maybe it's around $600 an ounce.
Well, it got up very close to $1,000 at one point and slid then back down. But then that compares with just 10 years ago, prices below $300 an ounce. It's been quite a roller coaster ride. I think anybody that 10 years ago decided to take a position in gold is feeling fairly pleased, even although we've seen the top of the market, and they're probably hoping that we'll see prices going back up. After all, when we talk about the price of gold, we're also talking about the gold price of dollars. And since there is an extraordinary expansion in the supply of dollars being engineered by the Federal Reserve in order to try to prevent a full-scale monetary collapse, it would be a reasonable assumption that at some point that will impact on the gold price, because nobody can increase the supply of gold as quickly as the Fed can increase the supply of dollars. The catch is that although the Fed is expanding the monetary base at full scale, full tilt, the rest of the banking system is not quite so ready to create money. And in fact, broader measures of monetary growth are slowing down and could even turn negative as banks try to contract their balance sheets. So this is quite a complicated question and shouldn't be thought of in a simplistic way. I don't think there's any guarantee that the price of gold will remain as high as it's been. I think if stability returns to the financial system, then investors will turn to assets that pay returns, interest or dividends, which gold doesn't. I mean, gold is only going to be valuable if its price changes. I'm afraid that gold doesn't come with an interest payment or a dividend attached.
As I mentioned, what you do in the book is you take a look at the development of a number of things, starting with banks, and you make this argument that really if a society is going to grow, you have to have a stable banking system. You have to have some way for people to safely borrow money. So the beginning, so where we start is with the creation of the idea of credit.
Right. Of course, if you go back to before the time of banks, credit was usually provided by individuals. The individual lender, sometimes known colloquially as the loan shark, doesn't tend to be a very popular figure. When you look at loan sharks even today, lending in the very poorest societies, they tend to charge very high interest on their loans. And that's partly because of the risks that they run. They are small operators. There are no economies of scale. And there is quite a high risk of default, particularly if you're lending to relatively poor people. So banks were a major step forward because they allowed economies of scale. They allowed diversification. You know, the more people that you take money from and the more people you lend to, the less risk that you run on average. And that moment when banks really began to take on their modern form in the period of the Italian Renaissance, the heyday of the Medici, is a period that fascinates me because it sees a transformation in the image of finance. Moneylenders go from being rather disreputable figures, often in the European case drawn from a religious minority, the Jews. They go from being figures stigmatized by the church to being figures of great power and magnificence. And the Medici embody this. They're patrons of the arts. They become politically hugely powerful. But I try to remind people in The Ascent of Money that these guys started out as foreign exchange dealers long before they became the patrons of Botticelli.
That's, I think, one of the interesting parts of the story, and that is how it is that being a banker became a respectable occupation, and how people became to go from the bottom of society to the top. They become patrons of the arts. They become important players in politics. And perhaps one shouldn't be surprised at either of those things, because to be successful in any of those spheres, or perhaps in any sphere really, you have to have money and you have to have access to ready cash.
In the 19th century, the German poet Heinrich Heine commented on the fact that the rise of financial wealth, of banking wealth, personified by the Rothschild family, was a social revolution, because up until that point, most wealth took the form of land. And to be rich was to own acres and acres of arable land. With the rise of money as a form of wealth, there was a fundamental social revolution. Money is very different, whether it takes the form of securities, bonds, stocks, whatever, financial assets. It's very different from land because it's mobile. And it's therefore much more straightforward to move it around. The birth of globalization is therefore closely associated with the increasing importance of money, of mobile wealth, and the relative decline of landed wealth.
And here it gets us again, maybe we're talking here about the close associations between people who have money and who lend money and where power is, that and perhaps takes us to the next thing you should talk about, and that is, as society grows, not only do you have to have ways for individuals to borrow money, but you have to, particularly, you have to have ways for government to borrow money so that they can build things and raise armies and do those things that they need to do. So you have to have a way for governments to do that, and also for corporations to do that. And so we come to the creation of the bond market.
Yes. Enter Mr. Bond, a key figure in the story. I try to tell financial history as a story, and a critical development comes in the period of the Middle Ages and later Middle Ages, when Italian city-states discover that they can finance their endless wars with one another, not just by taxing their citizens, which never makes them very popular, but by borrowing from the citizens and paying them interest on the loans. And this is the birth of the bond market, when governments start making arrangements to borrow long-term from their citizens. You enter a new era because these loans differ from other loans in being resellable. In other words, if I buy a bond from, let us say, the city of Florence or Venice, and the bond says that the city will pay me, in effect, 5% for the foreseeable future, 20, 30 years, maybe in perpetuity, that's great, and I'm happy to collect that interest. But if I decide that I'd like to have the money back, I can't really go back to the state and say, look, I've had enough of this, pay me back. What I do is I go to a secondary market, and I say to somebody, you know what, I have this bond here, it pays 5% a year, what would you give me for it? At that moment, it's really the moment when the bond market is born, when government debt and later, of course, the debts of corporations, can be traded in a secondary market. And it's fascinating to see how much volatility there could be in the early bond market. The price of a Venetian government bond would go from 100 right down to 20 or even lower when things were going wrong for Venice politically, when it was losing a war against the Turks. And so you have to introduce the idea of yields to fully understand how this works. A yield is essentially the nominal interest in a bond, that 5% I mentioned earlier, divided by the price the bond will fetch in the market. And if the price is way down, then that yield goes way up. That's one of the key concepts in financial history, the relationship between the bond market and interest rates. Because broadly speaking, the bond market sets the long-term interest rate. If a government is having to pay 10%, 15%, or 20% to borrow new money, then that will be the prevailing long-term interest rate throughout the economy, and that could affect, in modern times, for example, the mortgage rate. So the bond market's a crucial institution, and it remains as powerful today as it's ever been. In fact, it's going to be very powerful next year as governments all over the world scramble to sell bonds to try to finance their various stimulus packages, as we now euphemistically call giant deficits. So what's the bond market? It's going to be a really critical player in the first days, weeks and months of the Obama administration.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Neil Ferguson. He's professor of history at Harvard University, and he is the author of a recently published book, The Ascent of Money, the subtitle, A Financial History of the World. It's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are welcome, and we have someone who is standing by, ready to jump into the conversation, and that's welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller is in the nearby community of Belgium. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I got interested. I decided to give you a phone call because you were talking about barter. You were saying that barter doesn't really work. Well, maybe it doesn't work on the level of nations and stuff, which I might even take exception to that, because essentially all money trading is a different form of bartering to me. But I've bartered for everything. I've bartered for land. I've bartered for doctor services, lawyer services. I've bartered for food. I've bartered for everything. I can almost make a game out of it to see what all I can get. And it works pretty well for me. Now, maybe it doesn't work for everybody because they want to have their plastic because it's a little bit more convenient than carrying around a pocket full of bartering items. But it still seems to me, even when you're talking about bonds and everything else, you're essentially just bartering. You're bartering your nation's wealth for whatever you may want in the future. And you might pass it on in a form of money, but it's still barter.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you have a bank account?
Yes, because there's one area that I cannot deal with barter when it comes to dealing with governments. I have to pay my taxes.
Right. And there's a reason that the government doesn't want to be paid in you might be able to offer, but let's say loaves of bread that you baked at home. And the reason is that they're not fungible, and many of these goods don't last. They perish. The great advantage of money is that it's accepted universally in a society under normal circumstances, and it doesn't go bad. It doesn't go off. You know, if you think of a loaf of bread as an alternative, or for that matter, a cigarette, they simply don't last as long as even a banknote does. I agree with you that the barter can play a role, and indeed, it's something that most kids get a thrill out of before they really start to use money, when they go to school and swap an iPod for a Sony PlayStation game. They're engaging in barter, and that's something that we have a natural affinity for as humans. But if we all tried to live by barter, if even governments adopted barter, if every single one of us was having to do all our transactions, including paying the mortgage, with goods, there would be a tremendous slowdown in economic activity because it would be so inefficient. The transaction costs would be astronomical. Somebody wants to get me to write another book, but they say, you know what, Neil, we're going to have to pay you in shoes. And I'm going to say to them, well, wait a second, I don't need that many shoes. They say, that's all we've got. So then I have to go into the shoe business to try and exchange shoes for the things that I need. You can see why barter has only limited viability in a complex society.
Well, I don't barter in loaves of bread. Okay, I barter in services.
Right.
Is what I barter in, okay? And I do a service for somebody and somebody else then gives me what I want. And it really works in the opposite direction. You're absolutely right. It's difficult. If somebody comes to me and says, I want you to give me what I do for a couple of loaves of bread, well, I'm not sure I want to do that. But me, on the other side of it, if I want something, I go to them and I say, hey, I'll gladly build you something. And they say, fine.
The fascinating thing is that implicitly there will be a monetary role in this equation, because you'll be implicitly agreeing a price for your own labor, a per hour price for whatever it is that you do. And even if you don't say it to yourself, my guess is that the person on the other side of the deal is trying to attach a cash value to it. Even if we don't use money, we need some kind of standard unit of account, unit of measurement. It's possible, therefore, to have money which is invisible. It's just a yardstick. It's just something that we use to price things in, because it's hard to operate without that kind of yardstick. I mean, what is an hour of your labor worth in terms of bread or in terms of pasta or whatever it is that you like to eat? At some level, it's kind of easier to think in money than to think in loaves or to think in bottles of wine, for that matter. And that, I think, is why money is there from such an early stage in civilization. It's no coincidence that money is there right at the beginning, 4,000 years ago, when the first complex societies arise. It's no coincidence that in ancient Mesopotamia, most of the written records have to do with money. They're not poetry. They're not history. They're actually accounts and records of transactions. We need money because our complex society can't function on the basis of barter, even if in some rare cases like your own, barter can play a big role.
But that's what I was getting at. Societies can't deal with it, but individuals can.
Absolutely. Listen, individuals can do it, but it's marginal in terms of the economy as a whole. I would have thought barter transactions account for a very, very minute percentage of U.S. gross domestic product. One other point which is worth making, of course, is that what you could be engaged in is a sophisticated form of tax evasion. I wouldn't like to accuse you of that, but of course, in practice, if you're exchanging your labor for non-cash remuneration, that's going to be invisible to the tax authorities. That's why you get quite a lot of barter in economies where the tax authorities are weak. There's a lot of barter that goes on in a country like Italy or a country like Russia, where the fiscal authorities are relatively weak and people strongly object to paying tax. So that's another way of thinking about barter. It's a way of avoiding having cash, because once you have cash in any form, particularly once it's in a bank account, it's much, much harder to avoid paying tax.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. That was indeed the thought that was in my mind, at least the idea that perhaps a government, governments would like the idea of the development of money and financial markets, because that gives them greater opportunity to regulate transactions and also to take their piece.
That's absolutely right. The development of coinage in the period of antiquity and right through the period of the Roman Empire was bound up with the power of the state. That's why most coins bore the head of a king or queen or emperor, right down to the present day, when the coins of the United Kingdom and Canada still do have the queen's head on them. Once you monopolize the issuance of money, you create a revenue source for government, which has the wonderfully obscure name of seigniorage. If you create money, you have an ability to raise revenue simply by creating more of it. And whether it's through debasing the coinage or printing wheelbarrow loads of paper money, governments throughout history have repeatedly abused that monopoly on money creation. That's a really interesting point, actually, because it reminds us of the extent to which the history of finance is intimately bound up with the history of government, the history of the state. I often hear people talk about the market and the government as if they're somehow in opposition or even separate entities, that the market should prevail and government should yield or vice versa. And this is just to misunderstand the historical process. Government and the market have been intimately bound up with one another from the very beginnings of time. Governments have sought to monopolize money. They've sought to make sure that they can tax economic actors. And in crises, governments have stepped in, as we're seeing now, in order to mitigate the effects. So this is an extremely long-running and complex story, but I think a fascinating one.
Yeah, and at least recently, and perhaps this is something that goes back a long time, though, that perhaps the reason that we have this idea that there is this separation between the market and the government is that continuously people in government tell us that there is that separation, that it's important for there to be that separation, and that somehow they believe that the strength of the market lies in the fact that government doesn't get involved, when of course we know that government does get involved in many ways that are both subtle and obvious, and yet we continue to perpetuate, or our leadership continues to perpetuate, this idea that, oh, it's a, their attitude is that it's best if it's a hands-off, when in fact it's nothing like that.
I think that's right. A false dichotomy has been created in political rhetoric between the supposedly unregulated market and on the other side, a kind of benign, omniscient, omnipotent state. And I think it, particularly at this time of crisis, it's important to get away from those kinds of oversimplifications. There never was such a thing as a completely deregulated, government-free market. And if anybody ever tried to create something like that, they would very quickly find themselves confronting anarchy. Governments exist in order to regulate markets in some measure. Part of their function is to provide law courts in which disputes can be settled. An amazing number of financial transactions go wrong and end in dispute. And if there's no government, then the disputes can often be settled through violence. What governments provide is a judicial system whereby financial disputes can be resolved peacefully. And governments can regulate in such a way that crooks cannot or find it much more difficult to engage in systematic fraud. So if one takes the very long view, it should be understood as a constant to-ing and fro-ing between the private and the public sector. At times, the public sector can retreat and the market can appear to perform with less assistance and with less support from government. But those times never endure for very long, and the pendulum swings back the other way. It's happening now. This financial crisis has been the result of excessive indebtedness, particularly on the part of banks, but also households. It's partly been the result, though, of government interventions. After all, it was the government that intervened to say we must make more loans to relatively poor households or households of ethnic minorities to make it easier for them to own their own homes, because that is a good thing in itself. That is socially desirable. And standards were systematically reduced by government, by Congress. The way in which Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac operated was not some kind of product of the market. It was the result of political manipulation to try to increase by any means possible the home ownership rate in the United States. So I think one has to understand the crisis not just as the product of deregulation and markets running out of control. In many ways, this crisis has been the result of government action that was misconceived.
Let's talk with someone else calling from Sheldon. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm a big proponent of single-payer mortgage, and I invented the word. But I had a VA loan, and that VA loan was bulletproof. I don't think any VA loans, even through this crisis, have ever failed. And actually, if they're not paid off, they go back to the government picks up the tab, and they know exactly when it happens. If you sell that house before the house is paid off, the new owner has to pick up the entire thing, pay off the VA. Now, since much of the problem that we have today is from bad loans, and we've thrown hundreds of billions, if not trillions, into trying to stop the bleeding, but yet nobody has come up and said, let's have one bulletproof piece of paper where everything is spelled out and not 100 pages of paperwork that lawyers have written so difficult to read. And single payer is used internationally all over the place. Social Security is single payer. I mean, it's not a new thing. It's always worked for decades. Why don't we go to work and fix this now? Demand that it gets fixed.
Well, I think the idea that you could end up with a more simplistic, standardized form of loan, particularly for mortgage finance, is looking increasingly appealing. I'm not sure whether the Department of Veterans Affairs offers the perfect template, but I think what we're going to end up seeing is some kind of really quite radical simplification of the mortgage market. I wouldn't be surprised if by this time next year there hasn't been a large-scale restructuring of the entire system of mortgage debt. It seems to me that given that the bottom of the housing crash is not in sight, given that more and more homeowners are ending up in negative equity, given that a huge number of financial instruments are being dragged down as real estate prices fall, that more radical action may yet be required than what we've seen so far. And one hears occasionally schemes for this kind of overhaul, which would essentially convert most or all existing mortgages into something far more straightforward and standardized, say a 30-year fixed interest rate mortgage underwritten by the government. That's the kind of measure that in some ways was introduced back in the 1930s when the government first intervened in the mortgage market, when Fannie Mae was called into being. And I wouldn't be surprised to see something like this. We go back to basics and we try to rationalize a system that has become excessively complex. One thing that worried me for a long time was the growth of the adjustable rate mortgage in the American market. And it worried me because this had happened earlier in Britain, where there was a great deal more innovation and experimentation in the mortgage market and a radical move away from long-term fixed interest rate mortgages. In fact, you simply couldn't get a 30-year fixed interest rate mortgage in the United Kingdom 10 years ago or even further back. And the problem is that once you have a lot of adjustable rate mortgages, the market becomes far more sensitive to movements in interest rates. Britain had a very severe housing crash in the early 1990s, and in many ways that anticipated what we're seeing in the United States today. So I'm rather sympathetic to the idea that we probably need to get back to something simpler, because complexity in the mortgage market has been a recipe for financial instability.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're hitting into about our last 10 minutes, and I have some other folks to move on to. And very quickly, I'd like to introduce our guest. Once again, Neil Ferguson. He is professor of history at Harvard University. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you could look at his book, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. It's published by the Penguin Press. You should certainly be able to find it in the bookstore or library. Questions are welcome. We'll try to get as many as we can. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The next caller is in Clay City. This is line three.
Yes, I have a cousin who's a chemical broker, and it's not uncommon for him to trade commodities for other commodities. For example, he may be buying oil, but they may want to be paid in I remember he arranged for an entire shipment of chickens from a poultry company to be box frozen and sent to the location that he is. Isn't the barter system very much alive? And isn't our dollars basically our gross national product? Doesn't that basically ensure that the dollar's worth what it's worth? Thank you.
This is a fascinating subject. Of course, in those sorts of transactions, it's inevitable that there are prices because otherwise it would be extremely difficult to work out what quantity of chickens you would be prepared to exchange for a specific quantity of oil, or for that matter, wheat, or for that matter, pork bellies, or you name it. And I think that's the point that I would want to hammer home. We may not require cash to play a part in a transaction, but we're certainly going to be using money to attach prices, comparable prices, to the goods that we want to exchange. Of course, The commodities business has been a critical part of the history of Illinois, and particularly the history of Chicago. It was Chicago that pioneered commodities futures on its exchanges, and I suspect this is a particularly Chicagoan way of looking at the world, perhaps to be contrasted with the way that New Yorkers look at the world, which is with the dollar firmly in the foreground. But even in the Chicago markets, dollars are playing a part, if only in providing prices. Now, the question of the dollar's value is, of course, at some level, a function of the size of the U.S. economy as the biggest economy in the world. That is part of what makes the dollar attractive as a reserve currency to the rest of the world. But I think it's even more important that the dollar is the unit of account which commodities are priced in. People need dollars partly because oil is priced in dollars, and other economies peg their currencies to the dollar. I think this is the other point to remember. The dollar is ultimately worth what it will be accepted for in exchange for commodities, or for that matter, other currencies. And that will be a function of the quantity of dollars created by the Federal Reserve and the banking system, and the interest rate that can be collected on dollar deposits. Right now, the dollar is being mass-produced by the Fed, and the interest rate that you can get on a dollar deposit is falling steadily downwards. And in fact, we saw yesterday negative rates on some short-term treasury paper, an unprecedented development. So the price of the dollar is something that is going to fluctuate and possibly quite dramatically over the next 12 months. We've seen the dollar rally against other currencies in the very teeth of this financial crisis. But it wouldn't be surprising if by the middle of next year that trend reversed and we began to see the dollar weakening as the full magnitude of dollar creation becomes apparent.
All right, let's go next to Champagne for another caller, line two. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning. Don't want to put you on the spot, but are you acquainted with a little book called Fiat Money, Inflation in France by Andrew Dixon White?
I do not know that book.
Well, he was a historian and a diplomat. He was born in the 1830s and he died sometime in the 1800s. But he wrote a chronicle, it's 120 pages or so, about the vast printing of paper money in France after the French Revolution. And they seized all the church lands and used that as backing instead of using gold, for example, to back their assignats. And by the time they had finished printing them, only over 5 or 10 year period, they were just worth nothing. It's very much like what's going on in Zimbabwe. Now, you may have touched on this before. I didn't hear the beginning of the program, but I mean, could we be facing something like that with the dollar creation that they're doing now? Or because you say it's not getting out through the banks, so they're not loaning and so forth, are we pretty much immune from that?
This is a great question. The French Revolution saw one of the many episodes of hyperinflation that have resulted from the excessive creation of paper money. The Assignat episode was a classic, culminated with the mass incineration of printing presses and worthless notes. Something similar happened, of course, in the South at the end of the American Civil War. It happened in Germany at the end of both World Wars. In 1923, the mark was essentially worthless. And, of course, it's happening in Zimbabwe today. The nightmare scenario is that we could end up creating a similar situation by excessive money creation in the United States. I think that's a pretty low probability scenario right now, to be honest. The Fed is creating a lot of high-powered money at the monetary base, to use a technical term. That is to say, it's expanding its balance sheet, and it's ultimately now creating money by purchasing mortgages, securities, and now likely treasuries. But that is not feeding into a massive monetary expansion when you look at broader measures of money, because banks are not really lending that money on. In fact, banks are sitting on it, accumulating reserves, trying to get their balance sheets back under control because they've been so out of whack. And that means that, to use another famous phrase from economics, the Fed is kind of pushing on a string. It's injecting a lot of cash into the system, but the system isn't passing it on in the form of new loans. And that is, I think, the critical point. It would only really be a cause for concern if we saw rapid acceleration in measures of broad money like M2. We're not seeing that at the moment, and I don't expect to see it anytime soon. The deflationary pressures, the downward pressure on prices exerted by a global recession is something that is only beginning to make itself felt. And I think deflation is going to be a much bigger concern in the year ahead than inflation, particularly because when you've got falling prices, heavily indebted households and heavily indebted businesses really do start to struggle because the real value of their debts starts to go up.
Well, thank you very much for addressing that.
All right, thank you. We have another caller here, and we'll go to the caller, and that'll be on line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, in the last 30 years, we've had pervasive kind of what I'd term a free market fundamentalism, where the idea is that markets are self-healing, self-adjusting, and self-regulating. I would just like you to comment on this notion and how it's played out, in the current fiscal crisis. Thank you.
Well, I think one of the most important lessons of financial history that I point out in The Ascent of Money is that markets have a tendency to overshoot because they reflect nothing more than our expectations of the future. The price of a stock, the exchange rate of a currency is, broadly speaking, the result of the sum of all our expectations of the future value of the asset or the money. And we're not particularly good at knowing the future because there's huge amounts of uncertainty. We can't attach probabilities to all the risks that we face. And that means that our expectations have a tendency to fluctuate. Markets, therefore, have an inbuilt volatility. They may become relatively calm as they did in the period from, say, 2001 to 2006, when volatility declined spectacularly and it seemed as if a great moderation had arrived in economic life. But this was just the quiet before the storm, and we've seen the return of volatility with a vengeance. I don't think you can avoid this in a true market system, because we have to be given free play to set prices. And if we're given free play to set them, they're likely to fluctuate, and sometimes quite dramatically. When the mood shifts from greed to fear, from euphoria to depression, there will be dramatic moves in prices right across all asset classes. And there is no way of avoiding that short of the planned economy, short of imposing state-administered prices and state-controlled quotas of goods. This was tried in the Soviet Union and in other economies run on socialist or communist principles. And it turned out to be, unfortunately, a much less efficient way of allocating resources than the market. The market, as I've often said, is a bit like democracy. It's the worst of all possible systems, apart from all the other ones that we've tried from time to time. And so one has to just get used to living in an imperfect world and accepting that financial volatility is the price that we pay for a relatively flexible economy that responds to our changing demands.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. And just at the end here, I'd like to return to and give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about real estate, simply because I think some people would argue that one of the reasons we're in the spot we are now is that people have this belief that the value of real estate would just keep going up and up and up and up and up. And so what I'm interested in having you talk about here is why it is, and this is a feeling that goes back some way, why it is that we believe so strongly in real estate and particularly in the idea of individual home ownership.
Well, I think there's a sense in which this notion that we should all be homeowners is of relatively recent origin. It only really began to become widely accepted as doctrine in the 1930s. In the 19th century, only a few people owned their own homes. Most people were tenants on both sides of the Atlantic. And this notion of a property-owning democracy has a huge appeal to politicians of all stripes, but particularly I think it appeals to conservatives. Who like the idea that if people own their own homes, they are in some measure capitalists. They are in some measure stakeholders in the system and therefore more likely to be conservative in their outlook. There is indeed some evidence to support this proposition. But when you think about it from a purely financial point of view rather than from a political point of view, the reality is that for anybody to invest a substantial sum in a house on the basis of a mortgage involves them in making a one-way, highly leveraged bet on the price of a single asset, which is pretty illiquid in a crisis. Just try to sell your house at the moment to find that out. So we've embraced a political dream of the property-owning democracy without quite appreciating the financial downside of that dream. And the downside is that households have become incredibly skewed in their portfolios. They have their wealth disproportionately in real estate. And when the real estate market starts to fall, as it has in the last couple of years, that's a drastic decline in wealth with no offsetting hedge. People don't have sufficient exposure in other markets to try and hedge that risk out. So that's the problem. We've all become sold on this idea of property ownership. In fact, it's almost a reflex action. Once you get that first job, you start to thinking about buying that first house. But it hasn't turned out to be a particularly brilliant strategy financially, particularly for anybody who bought a house in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, as you say, it's particularly been true that certainly at least here, say, in the post-war period, that for most people, their most significant asset by far would be their home.
Right.
And that maybe for a while that worked okay, particularly as we went through a period of time when the values went up incredibly, so that people could have paid a relatively small amount of money for a house and be able to realize a great increase in its value. Assuming that we don't change that, though, that notion that people do want to own their homes and that will be a significant asset, do you think that we're going to have to do something differently, or are we going to actually back away from that idea?
I think we just have to get this in perspective. You know, prices in Chicago, I was just looking at the numbers the other day, are now back to where they were in November 2004. And so we've essentially seen a bubble in property prices in a relatively short time frame, which is inflated and then deflated. So a typical homeowner in Chicago is only as rich or poor, depending on how you want to look at it, as he or she was back in November 2004, which is a mere 4 years ago. I think we need, therefore, to keep this in perspective and not regard our losses as necessarily meaningful losses, because at the peak of the property market, the prices were wildly inflated. They were in large measure illusory. So I don't think we need to overreact here and say, you know what, this property owning democracy idea is a failure. I think we just need to realize that we did push it a little too far. We allowed uncontrolled credit creation and mortgage lending to blow up a property bubble. The bubble's now burst. It's probably going to go down some more. I mean, I don't think it's by any means over. I think we'll see property prices going down and down over the course of the next, 6 months. But the property prices won't go to zero. A house in Chicago is not worth nothing. And that's the point at which the market really does ultimately work. A floor will be found, and markets will start to clear and houses will start to shift. We'll all just have to get used to the harsh reality that we weren't as rich at the end of 2006 as we thought we were. That was the illusion.
And if you'd like to read more about the financial history of the world, you can look for the book that we mentioned. The title is The Ascent of Money, published by the Penguin Press by our guest, Neil Ferguson. He is professor of history at Harvard University. Professor Ferguson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.